He doesn't trust his feelings, she went on. I trust my feelings. I feel good about myself. It makes Ben feel strange. He feels he shouldn't feel good about himself. She began to talk about people in churches. They look like they enjoy suffering, women more than men. They say, think this, feel that. They can't get the two together. Ben's changed his attitude toward women, and that's nice. Have you changed yours toward men? Men are more than just toys for you to play with, you know. They are human beings just as much as you are. Are you seeing deeper into men now? Yes. I think more about the qualities of men than I used to. There are men who are good. It's like watching hearts. Women seem to do it easier. Maybe in your next life you may choose to be a man? I hinted slyly. Dolores paused, then sighed. That would be an experience. It would be an experience to see why they act as they do. Before you go, Dolores, do you think you could make a gift to Ben of some of your joyousness? As you say, he is too serious. Yes, she agreed at once. It has been fun talking to you, Dolores. Thank you, was her final word as she went into the light. Goodbye, and thank you. In this example, it did appear that the obsessive relationship had been of genuine help to both parties in several ways, even though a definite problem in certain others. The host, after being released from Dolores and several other entities, thanked me repeatedly with big, carefree smiles. I wondered if the gift from Dolores, the name means sorrows not at all appropriate for her, was already taking effect in Ben. Annie. This intelligent, vigorous young woman had been having difficulties in the movement class she has been taking. On a recent hike, a companion commented on her funny gait and odd movement in walking of which Annie had not been aware. She did know that her right hip had given her problems for many years, a condition diagnosed as idiopathic synovitis, which means that the doctors didn't know what the cause of the inflammation was. Her right knee also gave her trouble. She said that her right leg felt like a club. With only this much information, we decided to find out first of all whether all these problems were her own or belonged to an obsessing entity in her. It was no surprise to me when her yes finger indicated that there was such an entity present. In fact, there were three or more, said the yes finger. Following the general formula of calling out first the strongest entity present, although I do not know how the strongest one is selected, we found old Cleo, who described himself this way: I'm an old man, gray beard, 75 or 80 years old. I entered Annie when she was being bum, don't know why I chose her. I was gnarled with arthritis, hands like claws, had pain and stiffness in my body. I was shrunken. It was in Finland. I had no family, was just alone in the cold, in a little cottage in the snow. I cut wood, sold it, not sure anyone paid anything for it. I see a big pack of wood on my shoulder. Maybe I was just surviving. Got reindeer meat for food. I set lines in the woods, the reindeer tripped on them. No visitors. I'm all alone. I got banished from my village. The people of the town were throwing things at me. Dirty old man, get away from the children. They said I had been hurting the children. It's about the boys. They said I corrupted them. We smoked and drank together. I didn't do anything that everyone else didn't do. I slept around with the teenage girls in the village. The other men slept around with them, too, oh, yeah, but I didn't have a wife. The wives knew that their husbands were sleeping around. Everybody knew. Everybody pretended they didn't. I asked, how did the girls feel? Did they feel everyone was hypocritical? They thought it was great. The girls thought they were special, important. Asked to review his life, Cleo saw himself banished as a young man after being stoned out of the village, and going on a ship to a blue-green sea, the Mediterranean, where he had found a woman and lived the life of a pirate. Years later, as an old broken man, he went back to Finland to die, broken because I never did anything good. He admitted voluntarily that he stole, robbed, cheated. You have honesty, Cleo, I told him, that is a good start. And you have perseverance. Now get rid of the self-centeredness, greed, cheating, and lying. Brush out the arthritis, the gnarledness. Are you doing all this? Suddenly smiling, Cleo exclaimed, I can stand up, wait all. No longer was he shrunken, and when he had also cleaned up his feelings and thoughts, he said he had become a chubby blonde cherub. This type of transformation back to the innocence of childhood has been encountered every now and then as hardened entities clean themselves up preparatory to going on into a realm of astral peace. Now clean up Annie's body, fix up everything that you brought into her, I instructed him. I've cleaned out her hip, but the knee is stuck. It's not 69, loosened. The knee is not me, something else is in the knee, but the bones, in the hip, are all shiny now. He smiled. As releasements usually go, Cleo should have been ready now to go at once into the light. It turned out that there was another difficulty. Although Cleo could see a light, it was only a little pinhole. I can squeeze into it, got my arms through, pretty tight around the shoulders, they are too wide. Asked to discover why the shoulders were too wide, Cleo murmured, a lump in my chest like a piece of fat, hey. Looks like a piece of tofu, but it's guts no, a piece of brain no, a big fat cow's tongue. By questioning we found that the big tongue was a symbol of all the awful things I've said to my wife. You make me sick. You're repulsive. You disgust me. You're not worth the time of day, she says nothing. Go into her mind, I instructed, contact her thoughts. She's shrinking into a puddle on the floor, with pleading eyes. I've destroyed her. Nothing but black oil with eyes on top. Tears came, Cleo said they were his wife's tears. Talk to her, I suggested. That was the only language I knew. I learned it from my mother talking to my sister. No, she didn't talk to me that way. I'm her favorite, yep. So you grew up and talked like that to your wife, a female. Talk to the puddle on the floor as your mother used to talk to you. You're my favorite, but I don't mean that. She's not good enough, she deserves it. The things I tell her. Firmly I stated, now I am cancelling out those bitter things that you said to her, and the things your mother said to your sister, but if I'm wrong, I won't be her favorite. I can tell the truth, she won't love me anymore. He wept, I'm a bully, I pick on everyone. I haven't told her. 70. You are a bully to your wife now, as your mother was a bully to your sister. She drove my sister crazy, drove her into a mental institution and she died. And you drove your wife crazy, you drove her into a black puddle and she died. It's time to get rid of that attitude. Cleo nodded, Cleo, you do have honesty to look at yourself closely. Take that lump out of your chest. Throw it on the ground, give it a push with your foot. You don't want to keep it. You say it aches. It is melting away now into clear, pure water, flowing over the black puddle, calming and soothing and comforting. The eyes are closing in restfulness. When they open, there is hope in them. The eyes are looking at you, hoping. What do you say to the eyes? Cleo's answer was a whisper. I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Then in sudden astonishment, a whole body has formed up. I wish I hadn't, look at her. I never noticed before. She's gorgeous. What do you want to say to her now? Well, you are some dame if he said that she felt vindicated now, and he felt relieved. He saw the light above him now as a big manhole. I've been in the black slime of a sewer, I'm looking up, through the manhole at blue sky. The rest was simple and easy from here on. Cleo saw a cherub coming just to take you to heaven, but said his wife would have to wait. It's not her time yet, she has to regain her joy. We were told that we could not help her further today, so I bade Cleo goodbye and thanked the cherub for coming. Then I called the next strongest entity in Annie. This was a 17-year-old girl, Gladys, who had entered Annie when Annie, too, was that age, he said, it was above the knee. I don't remember dying, woo. I was making a right turn around the corner and the car came along and the bumper hit me. Goddam, I got in an accident, didn't I? I died right there in the street, on the cobblestones. That bumper flattened me to the ground. I hit the right side of my head. I got knocked down in the brain and I come up and I can see me lying there, and my left leg is killing me and I'm out of my body, and I'm flying, woo-oh-oh, what a ride. Rock and roll. Jim spoke again as himself, though still in hypnosis, but people don't know about rock and roll yet. I explained, Harry, in the state you are in, past and future and present don't make much difference. Now I need to explain some things to you. Jim has a right to his own body without anyone else being in it. You have been using his energy and he feels tired without knowing why. And you have been trapped inside of him and haven't been progressing on your own spiritual path. You have had fun with him and have enjoyed the sense of humor together. We've been buddies for years. We've had a good time. Yes, and that has been good for you both. But it is time for you to leave, and when you go you can leave him some of your good humor. I suggested that he brush out of himself sadness, sorrow, alcoholism, and so on. He interrupted me, "Well, I tell you what. I'm not too proud of my life. I drank a hell of a lot of whiskey. I didn't apply myself to anything. But I'm not a bad guy. Old Jimmy here, he's a go-getter." Then with sudden insight he exclaimed, "That's why I got into him, and he'd do okay on the work and I could just ride along. I'm tired," he finished. "Harry, finish brushing out the things you don't want to keep, like the alcohol addiction. You'll be given a chance to do better. Now look for a light." That car knocked the lights out of me. "Oh, yeah, let me tell you how it is. When ya come out of your body, they raise ya, and ya see your body, and then, have you ever?" "No, I don't suppose you have. Ya kinda hover like a spaceship over your body and it lifts ya, and you could if I fly and soar, and the light ye're talking about is the truth, and you can slash Z to the truth. But flying may get boring after a while." "Oh, you won't fly forever. Someone is coming to escort you to your own right place, much better than this down here on the earth plane. And you'll keep the friendship with Jim. Leave him some of your jesting, too. He needs a little bit." He asked, "Where did you get whiz?" "I've been learning lots in these past years. Do you know, Harry, that this is the year 1990 now? And you have been stuck down here since 1927. I won't argue with you. You want me to go so you can help Jim. You're helping him. And helping you, too, just as much as Jim. It will be much better for you, too. See or feel someone coming for you." "Well, but you see, the thing is," he broke off suddenly, "it's my mother, I think. She has that blue dress on again. And she has her hair all fixed up. I kinda took care of her. I ought to go with her now." He said he preferred not to call any of his old buddies to go with him. "Oh, no, oh, no, they drank too much. Just good old boys. Just because they drank, they weren't bad. But I'll go just with my mother now. Thank you for coming for Harry, Mother," I said. "She wants to thank you, Mom, for finding me." He and his mother left, and Jim no longer saw them. Then it was Robert's turn, but I glanced at my watch and saw that time was passing fast. When I mentioned Robert, Jim, still in hypnosis, laughed, "Ha, you're going to love him. I see a ship, a foremaster. Robert sails. He is in 17th century clothes. 26, a real handsome fellow, ruddy white skin, black hair pulled back in a bun, sharp features, bold. He's the captain. English, he's English, all right, a damn pirate." I spoke to him. "Robert, it is time for us to stop now, so I ask you to remain quiet in Jim until I can talk to you next time he comes. Just round up your personality into a comfortable little ball and stay quiet within him." "Oh, madam, you ask a difficult task. When a ship is sighted I might go off on my own. You wait until my heist is over." "There's no time then, we're too busy, we'll go now." He did promise me that during this interval he would not kill nor injure anyone, and that when I called next time he would come to us. It sounded as if he felt free to leave Jim and return to him. Robert was ready and waiting when Jim went into hypnosis at the next session. It was Jim's own rational mind that did not believe he was present. I cannot see or hear him. There is a handicap. The handicap was only in Jim's own conscious mind, not in his subconscious awareness, for the conversation with Robert continued easily, through Jim's voice. Robert said that he had been in his ship, one that he had simply boarded in full daylight in Plymouth Harbor in 1614 and used as his private vessel. When I asked him gently if he was what people call a pirate, he paused quite a moment before answering yes. But Jim was aware of Robert's feelings that he was no ordinary pirate, for he felt that he was superior to the others, had a sense of discrimination, never attacking just any ship but selecting only those with treasure, and that he had a sense of honor. It was in 1617, he said, that southwest of the British Isles the ship was struck by a storm astern. Water came in through the back. The water caught me, forced the slash orc of the water was like it just burst me out, of my heart, out of the ocean and down, sucking my body down. It caught me in the right side and forced me up to a corner of the sun of the galley, and pushed me through my body, through my heart. I was free of the ship, I rose out of the water and up. It was dark, he shuddered. Was it cold, Robert? Not so much cold as dark. How old was Jim when you found him?
7.
He needed a father. He suddenly sobbed.
And you felt you could be a father to him?
No, just a friend. I did not ask whether the sobs belonged to the 7-year-old child or to Robert. I told Robert that he could just pretend that all the dark, heavy things like anger, hate, jealousy, regrets, selfishness, greed, egotism, that all of those are like a filthy old overcoat, and just shed it from you and throw it away. You keep the wisdom you have learned, but get rid of that heavy dark overcoat. He indicated that he was doing so. And remember, Robert, that gentleness and humility can be strengths. Look inside yourself now and see the bright things there: courage, independence, and wisdom. And now think, did someone ever love you? A parent? A dog? A woman? Yes, a woman, Rachel. Remembering her, he could see the light, like light from the sun in the clouds. When the sun is setting, I'm going off the ship, to starboard. Into the light, yes, and Anna, my little daughter, is coming. She looks at me, and takes my left hand. He went with little Anna into the light, and blue takes its place, added Jim, when the light had withdrawn. He did not explain the color, and I did not inquire. 81. Then I asked about the next entity in Jim. The fingers said there was none. There was a little uncertainty from the fingers, yes and no, that one entity wanted to come out but another wanted to remain hidden. After a while I asked if one or more of them were ready to go into the light.
Yes.
Are all of you willing to go?
Yes.
Jim spoke. I see a woman in a carriage. She's in a black dress, dark circles around her eyes, angelic look. She's looking out. I spoke to her. Lady, Jim sees you. Why don't you change the color of your dress to a beautiful light blue? And make your eyes bright and clear, and smile? Look for the light, lady. That's the right direction. She's changing, her eyes are bright. The horse and carriage are moving into the clouds, silvery lined, beautiful clouds. The horse's color has changed from gray to dappled white. She goes with majesty. I did not ask more about the lady's story, for time was now short. But we felt that she was safely on her way into the light. Questioning Jim's fingers told us that he was now free of all invading entities and that this work was enough for today. The superconscious mind, answering through Jim's fingers, also said that there was no other important reason for Jim's insomnia. On returning to full awareness, Jim apologized. I don't know whether my thoughts of being conscious were a handicap. I tried to go deep for you. I laughed, because he had been so deep in hypnosis that at times his voice was barely audible, and then a remarkable sequel occurred. Jim, the down-to-earth, left-brain type who had no previous experience of this sort, sat up on the cot and, gazing across the room, began to describe in detail how Robert had obtained his ship. He described the town of Plymouth, up here, above the harbor, and told where the owner of the ship was in a house right here. He's middle-aged, has white knee-high stockings and knee-length pants, and he's rounded, gesturing to show a round belly, and he's really upset about something. Something about the barrels isn't right. They contain white powder sugar? No, I don't know what it is. Robert knows where the crew is and where the owner is. He and his crew just board the ship in mid-afternoon. Only two men are on board as guards. One just shrugs and thinks, why should I fight and die for what little pay I get? He tells the other guard, come on, let's go, and they just leave. Robert and the crew have to get the ship out of harbor while the wind is right. They just sail off, tacking back and forth. When I expressed amazement that Jim was now reading the Akashic records, no longer expressing Robert's individual words and thoughts, he explained to me, I just tell what I see. To him it was as simple as that, and he seemed amused at my interest in his sudden exhibition of psychic sensitivity. Jim felt that his early morning wakefulness was probably from Robert's influence. As captain, Robert was a light sleeper and may have had a habit of waking to check the ship mentally during the night. Jim had been specific that the time of his own waking was 3:36 a.m. Undoubtedly there was a reason for such pinpoint accuracy, but I had not remembered to ask the questions that would have explained it. If a question is not asked, the client seldom offers information voluntarily because of the slight drowsiness of the altered state. After returning to full awareness, however, the client may fill in many details which were not verbalized during the hypnotic state. In Jim's case, the surprise was that he relapsed spontaneously back into an altered state and was reading what he saw, world memories, Akashic records, the memory of nature. A month later I phoned Jim's home to check on one or two points in my written account. His wife answered and reported that although both of them still had restless periods in the early morning, as also do a good many other people these days, and still had strange dreams, not nightmares, Jim now slept definitely better than before, is a lot more restful than before, and he feels such a relief, has no anxieties anymore. The pressure is off. Laughing, she added, he is easier to live with now, and it was a joy to live with him before. I don't know how much more of this I can stand. Dr. Winifred Lucas included Jim's story in her two-volume work, Regression Therapy, A Handbook for Profession ALS, 1993. I want to express my appreciation to her for allowing me to use it here. Jim himself gave me full permission to use his real name, though I have chosen to use only his first name here. 84, Chapter 4 Releasement in Absentia, E. Remote releasement. Gradually more and more psychotherapists are finding the concept of spirit releasement extremely useful as a therapeutic approach and are becoming open to new and non-traditional ways to use it. One of these I have already mentioned, that of performing releasements without the presence of the victim, client, DRS. Edith Farr and William Baldwin seem to be the first of the modern therapists to use and teach remote releasement. Necessity has been the chief factor in my own use of remote techniques for releasing entrapped entities. When the person I suspected of being obsessed was a child or was someone living at a distance, it simply seemed sensible for me to ask a coworker or a relative of the supposed victim to be a channel for any invading entities. As hypnotists know, time and space in the altered state of consciousness are far more malleable and far less important than time and space as we know them in ordinary waking consciousness. And so I began what is now called remote releasement in those cases that needed intervention without the physical presence of the client. But what of obtaining the permission of the absent client? For babies and children, I felt that the permission of a parent was sufficient. For older persons, permission by telephone or letter was enough. But in cases when the person suspected of being obsessed was not aware of my suspicion, what should I do, especially if he or she might be amazed, or worse, at the idea of this work?
As several other therapists have also decided, I felt that in cases that seemed clearly to need such intervention, I could ask my coworker in hypnosis to contact the higher mind of the absent one and ask the higher mind if we had permission to release any parasitic entities. If the answer was no, we would abide by that, at least for the present session. At a future one, I might repeat the question, possibly rephrasing it. If a second no was given, I might ask the reason, but in any case we would do no work along that line for that person. Very seldom was the answer no, for the higher self of every person is wise, compassionate, perceptive, and always desirous of whatever is spiritually best for the lower self. When the client's higher self said it was all right for us to do a releasement, even in an unknowing person, we went ahead confidently. In one case when the answer was a no, we were told firmly that the person was not yet ready to deal with so great a change as a releasement would cause in the person's internal psyche, it would only confuse and start questionings. In a different situation concerning a man, when I received a no, I objected, "But he is a friend of mine. If I am a true friend, won't I want to prevent him from making a serious spiritual mistake, either by telling him of the danger or else doing work for him in his absence?" The answer was an emphatic, "No. It is not your responsibility. He has free will. If he leaves the right-hand path, makes a spiritually unwise decision, eventually he will return." Sadly, I felt that perhaps the eventual return might be in a future lifetime. I accepted the channel's decree, however, for it came from a high source. Nan Taylor's master. I had not yet learned at that time that I could have called the man's higher mind. As mentioned earlier, Eugene Morae performs all his exorcisms remotely, using a pendulum over a chart to decipher the characteristics and needs of a person whose name has been sent to him and the characteristics and strength of the entities in that person. Then he follows a verbal formula, asking higher beings to extract the parasitic entities. His book, Exorcism, 1988, gives his technique in detail. Dr. Irene Hickman uses by choice the remote method of releasement for the cases she describes in her book, Remote Depossession, 1994, although she has also performed releasements directly. Dr. Hickman's reason for choosing the remote method is to keep the personality factors of the host person from possibly influencing the results, her goal being to provide reliable material for research projects, noting the condition and complaints of the subjects, clients both before and after the remote releasement. As Baldwin points out, when we do a releasement directly, the client herself is the channel, for the entity is already there, whereas with a remote releasement a third person is the channel, receptive in hypnosis, and the entity in the absent client is called to come and speak through the channel. In my own practice I have found so little difference either in technique or in results that I do not think of one case as direct and another as remote. It is only because some people reading these chapters may still wonder about their feasibility of remote releasements that I make a separate chapter for some of my own cases. Half remote releasement by telephone. Geographically remote, a sort of half remote releasement technique was also the result of necessity. As mentioned earlier, with each new client I routinely ask permission and cue her to enter the hypnotic state thereafter at the sound of my voice as I speak two or three certain words, such as rest now, and have also programmed her to respond from the subconscious level through an ideomotor fmgrancer, one fmga having been programmed to be the yes fmga, another the no fmga. Then sometimes sessions need not even require an intim diet channel, courtesy of the telephone system. Elsie, one of the first such cases that I attempted in this manner was that of a first grade teacher, Elsie. She telephoned me from several hundred miles away, telling me of irrational fears, inability to think clearly, and feelings of desperation because her schedule for the children had fallen far behind in some subjects. These symptoms were of fairly recent onset. Since she had previously been cued to go into hypnosis at my voice, I suggested that she make herself comfortable with the phone receiver propped to her ear and the mouthpiece near her lips. I spoke the cue words, she went into the altered state, and we went right into a suspected releasement. Her yes finger moved, she told me, at my question, is there any mind or consciousness in Elsie that does not belong to her?